These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down, get off.
WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, the history, importance, and current struggles of Black farmers, land, and food. Africa World Now Project is next.
Of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward all researchers. And when you see that you got problems, all you have to do is examine the historic method used all over the world by others who had problems similar to yours. And once you see how they got theirs straight, then you know how you can get yours straight. Please. There's been a revolution, a black revolution, going on in Africa. In Kenya, the Mau Mau were revolutionaries. They were the ones who made the word Uhuru. They were the ones who brought it to the fore. The Mau Mau, they were revolutionaries. They believed in scorched earth. They knocked everything aside that got in their path. And their revolution also was based on land. A desire for land. In Algeria, the northern part of Africa, a revolution took place. The Algerians were revolutionaries. They wanted land. France offered to let them be integrated into France. They told France to hell with France. They wanted some land, not some France. And they engaged in a bloody battle. So I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you, you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn the other cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a non-violent revolution. Only kind of revolution that's nonviolent is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution based on loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution in which the goal is a desegregated lunch counter, a desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality.
This group of farmers say Stein and their distributors, who they met at a Memphis convention last year, pulled a bait and switch and sold them fake soybean seeds.
These farmers then started to notice that their soybean crops were not developing at the rate that was commensurate to what these certified seeds should have produced.
Thomas Burrell is one of the defendants and president of an association representing black farmers. He says he had the soybean seeds tested at Mississippi State. He says the test confirmed their suspicions.
They planted 100 of those seeds and zero of those seeds germinated.
But he says it's not just a matter of financial fraud.
These seeds now have become weaponized, and they are becoming now what is called, what we refer to as a blunt instrument that is being used to annihilate, eradicate, and wipe out the remaining few black farmers.
Produit suffisamment de quoi nous nourrir. Nous pouvons dépasser même notre production, malheureusement. Par manque d'organisation, nous sommes encore obligés de tendre la main pour demander des aides alimentaires. Ces aides alimentaires qui nous bloquent, qui nous inspirent, qui installent dans nos esprits cette habitude, ces réflexes de mendiants, d'assister. Il y en a qui demandent, mais où se trouve l'impérialisme? L'impérialisme, regardez dans vos assiettes, quand vous mangez les grains de riz, de maïs, de mil importés, c'est ça l'impérialisme, n'allez pas plus loin.
And the last speech you just heard was that of Thomas Sankara. In it, he asserts that our country produces enough food to feed us all. In fact, we can produce more than enough. But because of the lack of organization, we still need to beg for food aid. This type of assistance is counterproductive and has kept us thinking we are only beggars who need aid. I am asked, where is imperialism? I say, look at your plate. You see the corn, the rice, the millet? Imperialism is right there. The question of land as a fundamental aspect of Africana liberation movements is an often neglected point of inquiry when exploring the long genealogies of Africana thought and behavior, radical or otherwise. Nevertheless, it is indeed ever-present. A critical reading of the deep radical tradition found in the demands, treaties, and platforms of various communities of Africana people and organizations provide the historical reality of this fact. The declarations of the first Pan-African Conference and the subsequent Pan-African Congresses called for redistribution and access to land in the African world. As history teaches, most wars and revolutions around the world centered on land. Who owns it? Who controls it? According to Thomas Mitchell, in From Reconstruction to Deconstruction, Undermining Black Land Ownership, Political Independence, and Community Throughout Partitioned Sales of Tennessees in Common, the story of the federal government's failure to deliver 40 acres and a mule to Africans after the Civil War has long been part of the African-American folklore. This history has been highlighted in an opinion by a federal judge in a landmark settlement of the class action suit filed by black farmers against the United States Department of Agriculture. The case is known as Pickford II. The original Pickford v. Glickman lawsuit, named after North Carolina farmer Timothy Pickford, was filed against the USDA in 1997. The history of those African descendants who purchased land in states throughout the South during Reconstruction, however, remains largely unknown and uncelebrated. History suggests that in total, this group acquired approximately 15 million acres of land in the South in the 50 years following the Civil War. Further, unlike the large numbers of poor white men who were able to acquire land from the public domain under federal homestead laws in the late 1800s, African Americans who acquired land did so mostly by private market purchases, often under intentional and direct violence, limited access to credit, and overt discrimination. This new group of landowners, black landowners, who purchased rural land between 1865 and 1910 generally became owner-operators of farms. Consequently, the high water mark for black land ownership strongly correlates with the high water mark for the number of black farmers in the South. By 1920, there were more than 925,000 black farmers in the United States, and one in four black farmers owned that land. Almost all of these black owner-operators lived in the South. However, today, the pattern of land ownership in the rural African-American community represents the mere opposite of the trend in black land acquisition 100 years ago at the dawn of the 20th century. Remarkable levels of acquisition have been replaced by extraordinary levels of land loss in the past half century or so. Presently, African-American farm owner-operators, whether full or part-time owners, own little more than 2 million acres of land in the United States. Furthermore, in relation to food security and insecurity issues, Margaret Marietta Ramirez, in her article, The Elusive Inclusive Black Food Geographies and Racialized Food Spaces, argues that in recent years, there has been a growing conversation amongst food scholars, activists, and policymakers questioning the ability of food community projects to serve low-income communities of color. Within these conversations, the issue of participation is often raised, framed as something that can be remedied by conducting outreach or building a more inclusive project that better engages local residents. However, it can be argued that these efforts for inclusion in community food projects will continue to struggle to build participation in communities of color if they do not shift the power structures that exist within the organization itself. To be clear, there must be concerted efforts to reframe the conversation of inclusion by drawing attention to the ways that race is embedded in food project spaces and consider how alternative geographies can invigorate critical food studies. Once situated, the Black geographies can call attention to the ways we take for granted the geography knowledges that Black subjects impart, as well as the long-standing spatial politics, from segregation to incarceration to emancipatory strategies that inform Black lives. As a result, when critical food scholars consider what food desert residents seem to want, the geographies and voices of the communities in question will be at the forefront of these analyses. The alternative geographies of the marginalized are embedded in the neighborhoods activists seek to transform, and their differential knowledge reimagines the politics of place. Today, we will hear a recent address delivered at the recent Bugs Conference, which was held in Durham, North Carolina, October 19th through the 21st. The Bugs Conference, of which Bugs is an acronym for the organization Black Urban Growers, was titled Roots, Resilience, Preserving Black Land, Reclaiming Self-Determination. The conference is just part of the work that Bugs is committed to institutionalizing and internationalizing to fuel, sustain efforts for sustainability and self-determination for communities of African descent as well as the African world. Black Urban Growers is an organization committed to building networks and community support for growers in both urban and rural settings. Through education and advocacy around food and farm issues, they nurture collective Black leadership to ensure that there is a seat at the table for Black farmers and Black growers. In November of 2009, Black Urban Growers began organizing and hosting a series of community events with the purpose of starting a conversation around food. Where does it come from? Who is providing it? Why don't we see more Black farmers at the farmers markets? What is the relationship between our individual health and the health of our communities? And why does it matter? Since 2010, Bugs has convened the Black Farmers and Urban Gardeners Conference, a national conference bringing together Black farmers, food justice advocates, educators, chefs, and concerned members of the Black community from across the country to share best practices and to build a stronger network of Black leadership in the movement for food justice and food sovereignty. What we will hear next is Dr. Monica White, who gave one of the keynote speeches at this year's conference. Dr. Monica White earned her PhD from Western Michigan University in sociology. She is currently an assistant professor of environmental justice at the University of Wisconsin-Madison with a joint appointment in the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the Department of Community and Environmental Sociology and is a former chancellor's postdoctoral fellow in the Department of African American Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Dr. White's research engages communities of color and grassroots organizations that are involved in the development of sustainable community food systems as a strategy to respond to issues of hunger and food inaccessibility. Her publications include Sisters of the Soil, Urban Gardening as Resistance Among Black Women in Detroit, and D-Town Farm, African American Resistance to Food Insecurity and the Transformation of Detroit. Her recent book, Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance and the Black Freedom Movement, 1880-2010, contextualizes new forms of contemporary urban agriculture within the historical legacies of African-American farmers who fought to acquire and stay on the land they were rooted. Using historical and contemporary examples, Freedom Farmers examines the development of farmers' cooperatives as strategies of resistance and documents the ways that these organizations in general and Black farmers specifically have contributed to the Black Freedom Movement. As a result of her scholarship and community work, Dr. White has received several grants, including a multi-year, multi-million dollar research grant to study food insecurity in Michigan. She has also received several awards, including the 2013 Olson Award for Distinguished Service to the Practice of Sociology from the Michigan Sociological Association and the Michigan Faculty Staff Community Service Learning Award. She was appointed to the Food Joint Task Force, sponsored by the Institute for Agricultural Trade Policy, maintains a highly ranked and reviewed blog, Soil to Soul, and has presented her work at many national and international community organizations, colleges, and universities. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
This is at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. That's because they wouldn't treat her right in Detroit at Wayne State University, so she's split, but she's still representing the D wherever she is. In town? Her research investigates communities of color and grassroots organizations that are engaged in the development of sustainable community food systems as a strategy to respond to issues of hunger and food inaccessibility. Her recent publications include A Pig and a Garden, Fannie Lou Hamer and the Freedom Farms Cooperative, which was in Food and Foodways, Explorations in the History and Culture of Human Nutriment? Is that Nutriment? Yeah, Nutriment. I had never used that word before. Nutriment. Her first book, which is coming out soon, entitled Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance and the Black Freedom Movement, is under contract with the University of North Carolina Press and is scheduled to be released in fall of 2018. This is fall now. Next month? November? We'll be looking for November. Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance, and Black Freedom Movement revises the historical narrative of African American resistance and breaks new ground by including the work, roles, and contributions of Southern Black farmers and the organizations they form. The book traces the origins of the Black farmers' organizations to the late 1800s, emphasizing the activities during the late 1960s and early 1970s. And also I have to say that she makes a link between the modern movement of Black people trying to be self-reliant and also kind of gives a shout out to DBCFSN in Detroit. In addition to her academic work, she is the past board president of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and has served on the advisory board of SAFON. Give a shout out to SAFON. The Southeast African American Farmers Organic Network. She's active in the food justice movement for over a decade, especially in Detroit with DBCFSN. Her work in the classroom and community embodies the theoretical framework of collective agency and community resilience, and the use of community-based food systems and agriculture as a strategy of community development. Give a strong buzz welcome to Dr. Monica White. Whoop, 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 whoop.
That new word, man. We're going to call the ancestors in here today, y'all. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to share with you something that started in the work of urban agriculture, and I wanted to sort of trace the trajectory and to understand what other ways have we as Black folk used agriculture as a strategy of resistance and resilience. Of course, you have to go to the South in order to understand and unearth, and it was in 2013 that I asked your blessing. I asked your permission to allow me to continue to collect the data and to write the book. And it will be mailed out, if you have pre-ordered, available in 5 stores in December. And so I'm hoping that the work that we have done, that we see this as elevating our work as farmers, our work as freedom fighters, and as a continuing of the legacy of the relationship between land, food, and freedom. So I'm eternally grateful to you. Oh, Mama LaDonna Redmond, who is not here, but sent her love to all of us for the support and encouragement in the passing of her son. She asked me to give you a message. She said, don't get distracted, y'all. Don't let the news get you distracted. We need to understand what time it is. We need to understand what our strategies are. We need to understand the importance of our history as we decide, make some decisions on how we proceed in this current moment. If you don't know it, our institutions are under attack. My very first teaching position was at Bethune-Cookman College, now Bethune-Cookman University, and the institution is being threatened because they're not able to get out of the financial situation. So if you don't realize that our black institutions are under attack, we need to mobilize, we need to organize, and I'm hoping that the scholarship that I present before you today will give us some guidelines and some ways to move forward in this new moment. One of my favorite quotes ever is by Benjamin Carr. He says, "The reason I have always wanted to be a farmer is because I believe then and I believe now that the farmer is the only free man we have in our race." Reverend Paris told me, "You can free yourself when you can feed yourself." I want us to sit in that moment and recognize how powerful it is for us to recognize when we can control the food, we can control a whole bunch of things. Understanding and recognizing how critical food is to our communities, to our celebrations, to our everything, food is essential. And I can't start without also recognizing my granddaddy and my grandma. Mm. My granddaddy was a farmer in Eden, North Carolina. I got North Carolina roots. During the summers, they would send us down either here or to Mobile. And I knew that my granddaddy was a farmer, and I also knew that he had a store in the front of the house. What I didn't know until after I wrote the book was that my granddaddy was a member of a cooperative. Mm. He and 9 other farmers had pulled their resources together to buy a vehicle and some tools, and the store in the front of the house they called the community store, and that was where black farmers in the neighborhood could buy with respect. Ain't that something how life is? This is also my dad, and my dad was also, he would call himself Farmer White, and he had a garden, a backyard garden. We had some land in Michigan, but he taught me the importance of making sure that anything you do is of benefit to all of us. And so it was through his example as a professor at Wayne State in educational psychology that he taught me the value of education and making sure that I return whatever it is that I collect and share with you. And so I think that, you know, Shirlette was telling us how important farmers have always been. We've been especially important in our various movements for resistance and resilience. However, the work of farmers, because it's been overlooked. And so we want to really change that trajectory. And in order for us to have young folks involved in this movement, we have to change the narrative from slavery, tenant farming, and sharecropping to agriculture as freedom and resistance. Mm-hmm. And so in doing, I think it's important that we recognize these are the farmers who welcomed the Freedom Riders. Now, the Freedom Riders were students, college students from the North, who came to help Mississippi organize for the right to vote. What many people focus on is that the Freedom Riders were there. What they don't understand, what we really need to sort of interrogate is what was the structure, what was the format that allowed all of these outsiders to come into Mississippi? What was the framework? What was the social network? What were the ways of communication that farmers especially were able to create the mechanism? Because surely they weren't able to be successful coming out from the outside unless they had been organizing on the inside. So never ignore the work of those who are unseen. Pay attention, and no one is voiceless. We just choose to ignore. No community is voiceless. We choose to not hear. And so I think it's important to sort of think about, like, what do we know about farmers as freedom fighters, right? What does that look like? Here's an organization, the Mississippi Freedom Labor Union, who was a part of the Delta Ministry for National Council of Churches, and they wanted an increase in pay. And because they were the laborers, they said, look, this isn't working. You either increase our salary or we won't pick your harvest. And given that relationship, they were able to demand higher wages. But that's not the only way we think about resistance. As a sociologist and someone who studies social movements, we can think about protests, marches, and boycotts. And those are all important. There are sometimes some things need to be shut down, right? But I also think that there are other ways of resistance that often gets overlooked because we're not paying attention. And for me, if this ain't a sign of resistance,
right,
I don't know.
Right.
Mama Faye. Mama Asantewaa, I think I still have that piece of paper that you gave me. We were doing a presentation for Growing Power, and Mama Asantewaa wrote me a little piece of paper and said, Fannie Lou Hamer, Freedom Farms. That piece of paper changed my life. Thank you, Mama. And so I give a lot of respect to Mrs. Hamer because I feel like what she was able to do was really monumental. If you think about what it meant to be in the 60s, to have the right to vote, or at least in theory, but to go to vote, to be fired and evicted because the folks you worked for disagreed with your decision to vote. And then, like, what must that have felt like to be a sharecropper or a tenant farmer and to be evicted and homeless with your family? Mama Fannie said, wait, y'all, don't go north. You leave the land, you leave everything. Everything comes from the land. So what she did, she created Freedom Farms. And Freedom Farms had, anybody tells you urban ag or community gardening is new, then tell them that's not true. Anybody tells you Head Start and the programs of mobile health care, all kinds of activities that they were able to do on 680 acres. I have some pictures later on that I'll show you. But understand that these roots of resistance, these roots of community building, that's a part of our legacy. And we need to tap into that legacy to figure out our way forward. And we can't do it without each other. This is a picture, just talking about the historical relationship between black folks and those that work. We often talks about our negative interactions with the land, but that's not the whole case. This is John Hatch, one of the organizations that I studied, North Bolivar Community Farm. He's standing in his co-op fields. And they were able to do, so Freedom, Fannie Lou Hamer and Freedom Farms was in one area. North Bolivar was part of a whole county. And then I also in the book talk about the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, and just that it celebrated its 51st anniversary of working to organize, mobilize, and to assist black folks who are doing the work. Another beautiful quote, it is pleasant to know that in color, form, and features, we are related to the first successful tillers of the soil, to the people who taught the world agriculture. Thank you, Frederick Douglass. There is no reason why the Negro should not control the Negro trade and handle the money that the Negro has to spend. Does that make sense today? Can we say thank you, ancestors? So in studying these organizations from the late 1800s up to the present, a friend of mine, Suniata Chajua, said, I was gonna actually have the book include all of these different organizations. He said, Mo, you can't do 100 and some odd years of cooperatives, you gotta finish the book. So I made a decision to study to concentrate the book on the late 1960s, the Southern Cooperative Movement, when black folks were making the decision to stay in the South, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. But what I've done through looking at all the different organizations that I've been able to identify, I wrote down all the activities that they did. Then I categorized those activities. Y'all students, y'all listening? We'll be tested on this later. So what did they do? How do we make, what did what they do, what did it mean to the community? And then how can we explain it? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
What did they do? How did it mean something to the community? And then how do we understand it so we can replicate it? And doing so, I came up with a theoretical framework called collective agency and community resilience. When we think about agency, we think about making the decision to change some component or aspect of our lives. But that is a psychological framework. What happens when, like, folks in Detroit or folks in Durham? What happens when we pull our resources together to make a decision? Enough is enough, I'm not gonna take it. There's no collective framework that really sort of captures that. So I talk about collective agency. Social actors' ability to create and enact behavioral options necessary to affect their political future. When we talk and think about resilience, we often think, especially here in North Carolina, what happens after a catastrophic event? How are people supporting one another? For me, there's a community component to resilience, and it includes ways to adjust, withstand, and absorb disturbance and reorganize while undergoing change, emphasizing structured approaches, community engagement, types of indigenous knowledge, emotional experiences, interracial exchanges that communities need in order to adapt to unforeseen conditions. So to me, the question isn't how do people pick up after something horrible has happened? The question is, once we get everybody safe, how do we push back against the structural forces that created the weaknesses to begin with? What makes our community so vulnerable, and how do we recover? So I don't want us to just say, isn't it great, something happened, somebody came and they shoveled me out. That's great, that's important, that's immediate. But I also want us to recognize how important it is for us to say, why is it that these communities are the ones that are in the most vulnerable places and spaces, and how do we push back against that? So a part of a theoretical framework means that you have a couple of strategies. What do those strategies look like? Well, one is common as praxis. And I want you to think about me.
We are currently listening to Dr. Monica White, who gave one of the keynote speeches at this year's Bugs Conference. Dr. Monica White earned her PhD from Western Michigan University in sociology. She is currently an assistant professor of environmental justice at the University of Wisconsin-Madison with a joint appointment in the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the Department of Community and Environmental Sociology, and is a former chancellor's postdoctoral fellow at the Department of African American Studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Dr. White's research engages communities of color and grassroots organizations that are involved in the development of sustainable community food systems as a strategy to respond to issues of hunger and food inaccessibility. Her publications include Sisters of the Soil, Urban Gardening as Resistance Among Black Women in Detroit, and D-Town Farm, African American Resistance to Food Insecurity and the Transformation of Detroit. Her recent book, Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance and the Black Freedom Movement, 1880-2010, contextualizes new forms of contemporary urban agriculture within the historical legacies of African-American farmers who fought to acquire and stay on the land they were rooted. Using historical and contemporary examples, Freedom Farmers examines the development of farmers' cooperatives as strategies of resistance and documents the ways that these organizations in general and Black farmers specifically have contributed to the Black Freedom Movement. As a result of her scholarship and community work, Dr. White has received several grants, including a multi-year, multi-million dollar research grant to study food insecurity in Michigan. She has also received several awards, including the 2013 Olson Award for Distinguished Service to the Practice of Sociology from the Michigan Sociological Association and the Michigan Faculty Staff Community Service Learning Award. She was appointed to the Food Joint Task Force, sponsored by the Institute for Agricultural Trade Policy, maintains a highly ranked and reviewed blog, Soil to Soul, and has presented her work at many national and international community organizations, colleges, and universities. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
Well, one is commons as praxis. And I want you to think about these as components or elements of your organization. How do our organizations encompass some of these get free? I call them some get free. I want you to have some of this get free. Right? One is commons as praxis. And for me, this looks like an organizing strategy that emphasizes community well-being and wellness for the benefit of all. When I ask folks in Detroit why they had a backyard garden and they worked at D-Town, the importance was, I don't even harvest what's at D-Town. I do that as a volunteer. That's out of love. I want to make, and you know, just talking to Black folks who are involved in agriculture, it's important for me to do this, not for my kids. In addition to my children, I'm looking out for other people's children. So this community component, this idea of community wellness, is very much integrated into what we do and who we are. What does commons as praxis look like? Shared ideology, moving from the individual to the collective. It's not me and mine anymore. It's us and ours. It's a cooperation and a collective. making community decisions around shared spaces and resources. What do we do with this land? How do we want to use this water? Where do these seeds, how do we make sure that these seeds are shared and have access? And we move from looking at a condition as oppressive to figuring out how to create and to make it liberatory. Prefigurative politics is acting as if. Does my organization allow for people to be active? Do your votes matter? So even in situations and conditions when we were not able to participate in the electoral process, and I say that in past tense, but some of that is right current. Mm-hmm. If you ain't paying attention, you better. Mm-hmm. There's a reason they don't want you to vote. So the idea to me is, if in fact you don't participate, our organizations have to be created such that we have a sense of political education. So we make decisions about how these organizations work. And that political education allows us to demonstrate our own voices, to hear the power of our own voices. And I think that is really critical. And so prefigurative politics, the creation of alternative political systems that are democratic and include processes of self-reflection. One, if we're excluded, and we have been, from political process, working in our organizations creates a free space. And what does that free space look like? It looks like a place where we can talk, we can be black, we can celebrate culture, but also we can educate and learn about some other strategies. And I think DBCFSN is doing quite a bit of that with the listening sessions and education sessions, the political education sessions for the co-op. You can't just say, here's a co-op, build it, they'll come. We have to describe why is this different as a regenerative model versus a restrictive extraction model. Right? How does this money regenerate within that community opposed to all the money and resources coming out of it? Self-management and political education. Here, economic autonomy and independence. It's important that we recognize that the dollar isn't the only way to value someone's labor or someone's gift. And so by this, I mean an alternative system of resource exchange within a community with direct benefits for its members. It could be sweat equity, it could be detail dollars. Right? But we have to be thinking about income and exchange in a different way. One of my former colleagues talks about an hour's work for an hour's work. Now, I can tutor his children, he can be my dentist, both are important, an hour's work, none is more important than the other. How do we do a different kind of exchange that isn't based only on resources? So resource regeneration versus extraction, alternative economies and currency, and also moving from individual to collective and cooperative. There's probably no subject more important than the study of food. How much do I love George Washington Carver? And the more I learn about him, the more my heart just is endearing to me. Who is our next George Washington Carver? Is he in his office? And he or she, are they in this room? Who are they? All right. So we need to be thinking about how do we make sure that we have what we need in our community. This is Mrs. Hamer in the hat and the scarf at the community store. What they did was 10% of all that they harvested went into the co-op store. That 10% was used to feed families who were not able to work. So it would be the elders and those. And they often, there was one time they had so much that they shipped the food from Mississippi to Chicago where the folks had left and moved. From Mississippi, North Mississippi. Yes, ma'am, thank you. Here's a picture of the sewing cooperative. So cooperatives as an idea is an important economic, but it's also a political frame. This is an example of the sewing machines came from an organization in Madison, but the sewing cooperative had childcare. They had childcare facilities for the employees, and the products that they made were sold in stores, and also had a leather smith who was doing some important work. Here's another example. It's not working. Think Young, think Andrew Young. Y'all too young to know about that. In addition to the sewing cooperative was the pig bank. And I've heard that some folks in Detroit are doing a chicken bank. So what this means is that you had an animal, and once the animal was pregnant, then you would share those piglets with a family. Once they matured, then you would pass on those babies, those piglets, to somebody else. They called the pigs bank on wheels, on legs, and it took 2 years for them to mature. So we need to be thinking about how do we make sure that our resources regenerate. another example of the skinny pigs. So I love this picture because it shows what was, but what can be. So these are the houses that were established in Ruleville, and you can see that on a good windy day, the wind would go through your house. There'd be no protection, often no floor, often one room. But Mrs. Hamer was like, yeah, that's not good enough for my people. So they had a 100 unit housing development. Here are the blueprints for it. 100 acres for low income, high quality housing. And here's what that looks like. I love and talk about Reverend Paris all the time. I don't know if he even knows I have this picture, but it's in the book. This is Reverend Paris, and this is at the Federation, the Trading Center in Epps, Alabama. If you want to know what free land feels like, you might want to go to Epps. It's a beautiful example of the strength and power of collectives and cooperatives. So all the tools that we had and needed were shared. The tractor. Doesn't make sense for 15 farmers to have 15 tractors. Why don't we have one tractor, we all put into it, and we all keep up with the upkeep of it. And in that way, I mean, just think about how powerful. So my question to you is, what kinds of activities are you doing that are collective and cooperative? How are you working with instead of against other folks who look like us? How can we even cross state lines, city lines, rural and urban? How do we build what this looks like? How do we make this happen? So I have some more questions for y'all. I'm almost through. So Booker T is complicated. And darn knows we went through some things. I was writing about him and we went through it. We went through it. So I had to okay, let me just delete, and let me be open, and he made me mad again. So I'm like, come on, bro. I'm trying to come on, look out for me. Right? So I think that we can talk about who he was as a person of that time, but also recognize there's something that's really critical in what he did. He taught us the importance and the value of Black institutions. I started my comments by saying our institutions are under attack. Mm-hmm. Booker T showed us what to do with very little resources, but with the solidarity of a community that supported him. I think we need to go back to that example. I love Du Bois, and while people often talk about the talented 10th, we fail to recognize that later on in his life, he stopped talking about the talented 10. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I argue that they're really pretty much, right, they're talking to each other. And so given this, Du Bois argued that, okay, so yes, we do have segregation. What does segregation allow us to do? It allows us to unify, to unite, to come out as a united front. What does that look like, right? What are we doing to unite with others? Where's the scientific agriculture, right? Who's studying this from an intellectual standpoint to make sure that the studies that are done in the institutions that we serve are also useful and beneficial to the community folks? And here's the sister who put it all together, showed us what it looks like. Here's an example. Now, there are a lot of people who, and even a graduate student, graduate assistant of mine, came in the office and was like, well, I would like to call into question. I'm like, ooh, boo-boo. Do I want to back up? So the question was, if it only lived a short time, was it successful? Mm. And to me, we have to think about what success means. Mm-hmm. That version may not be successful, may not have been. But the next version, she gave us a blueprint. And that's why we need academics to go back and get that history in Sankofa style and bring it before us. And to show us, what should I have learned from Mrs. Hamer? Here are the examples, and here's how we can make this happen. Here's what it would look like in a today, in an example today.
That's success.
That's success. Thank you. So the book will be out, and I do hope that you all are pleased. I hope it serves your needs. I hope you learn something, and I hope it encourages you to do a few things. One, how do we organize? And two, how do you even look in your own family tree to collect that history and to recognize the importance of land and food production in your own community? And the next project that I'm working on, this is current picture of Reverend Paris and his brother George. Their father was the first USDA loan officer in the state of Alabama. I'm actually arguing he was the first Black USDA loan officer. So the elder Paris did a lot in terms of agriculture, but he wasn't playing with no civil rights. You didn't give him respect, he couldn't use your restroom, he was going to report you. His son, Reverend Paris, then became active in every single civil rights movement organization of his lifetime. I just asked him, can you just tell me the organizations you've been active in? 20 minutes later, I did a search, and he's just active in so many things. And so they've asked me to help them write a family biography, and I'm really honored to do that. I feel like it's super important for us to know who are the people, because it is listening to their stories of how they got over that we figure out how to make it through this moment. Here's a picture of Mr. George showing me on the pathway from Selma to Montgomery where they had to use the restroom. So if you think that this stuff is all past, it's not. And let me say this, please let's not say history repeats itself.
Yes.
History does not repeat itself. People repeat history.
Yes.
Let's make sure we understand the strategies may be the same and the resistance will be stronger, but history in and of itself does not repeat itself. We fail to learn what we should have and how do we move forward. The next project that I'm working on is Mr. Page, who's no longer with us, he's now an ancestor. He heard my first presentation on agriculture as resistance. He came up to me and he said, nice job, young lady. But I want you to also think about the importance of fishing, angling, as self-provisioning. So after I finish the Paris book, the next book is on the importance of angling black anglers on the path to freedom. Mm. Not only did we... I can't do it all by myself. So what I recognized was that while, you know, fishing was important in my family, a lot of us have relatives who fish in Madison. You don't see a lot of black folks doing a lot of social activities. You will see some black folks fishing. And so it's current, but also I'm thinking, okay, so in order for us to find the Underground Railroad and to survive, we had to have protein as a source and we had to use the waterways to navigate that. Where is that scholarship? I haven't seen it. So if you don't read a book that captures your ideas, then it means you need to write it. And then also understand that the waterways as protein as a path to freedom, they paved their way through the fish that they caught. And it's the sisters. The sisters are also important to this conversation. These are shad fishers in 1915. So, in closing, what are resilient communities? We are able to connect the conversations of land to food, education, employment, safety, transportation, housing, and healthcare. So I'm giving you a charge to think about what are the ways that you do collective agency and community resilience, and how are we preparing our communities to withstand whatever this current moment is. Future projects, I've got some articles coming out on black and Latinx farmers in the state of Michigan. The Paris Family Biography, I have a quarterly column for the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development. I also wrote an article with a book chapter with my student Ike on race and food, agriculture resistance in U.S. history. And I'm ready, Mr. Burkett is not here. He's gonna be my next biography. Love and appreciate you all, thank you.
Culture. Universal. As I stroll down my street, Africa's a boiling, overflowing inside of me. I used to sport a curl made by Jerry.
A Jerry curl.
But as time passed, it didn't last. After my curl, I never combed my dude. I used to sport a cap, but the naps kept shining through. Shining. My sister got a brand new perm. My boys say she looks pretty fine. Body real firm. Folks at a job, loves a new touch up. I can tell a white boss gets a kick when she's all done up. My sister loves her blackness, but the U.S. says that her perm is her attractiveness. But Africa keeps coming stronger. We found out it ain't a perm, it's a temporary.
Uh-huh. Don't have cash to go to the music school. But money for the guitar or the violin or the tuba. My mom's had a record player and the 45s. I put the needle on the record and I kicked a crazy lie. Scratching it up, catching the breaks. Spirits within me have me do what it takes. Grammys I win.
And once again, like my Egyptian kin,
it's Africa within, making something out of nothing.
Africa's inside me, taking back her child. She's giving me my pride.
sapiens hustlings and to exist as Afro USA men. Residing in Pumani once was Christian, starfish like FOS and by origin.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.